Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1, I'm Chris Boyd. How critical is a dose of straight talk for the health of Americans? As Surgeon General during the early days of the Clinton administration, Dr. Joycelyn Elders earned both passionate supporters and outraged detractors by speaking her mind on everything from human sexuality to illegal drugs. 18 months into her tenure, she was forced to leave that post in a firestorm of criticism over her suggestion that masturbation might be a useful part of the sex education curriculum in public schools. But Joycelyn Elders was hardly finished. She returned as a professor of pediatrics to the University of Arkansas Medical School, and at the age of 76 remained a tireless advocate for public health and for frank discussions of the things that play into it. Dr. Elders, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why is it that Americans spend more on health care than any other country in the world, and yet on a variety of measures, things like infant mortality and life expectancy, we do so much worse than many other countries in the developed world?
You know, in fact, we are ranked number 26 out of the developed nations as to our health. One of the reasons for this is because we don't educate our people on how to take care of themselves. We are a health illiterate society. We have the best doctors, the best nurses, the best immunizations, the best medications in the world. The problem is, we have not taught our people how to be healthy. So we've got sick care. The thing is, we just don't have health care.
Do you think that the quality of our health system has allowed us to be health illiterate?
Well, I think we fail to educate our society on the value of health. We've been so busy taking care of problems. You know, we felt we could take care of it until we didn't prevent it. We spend, out of our $2.3 trillion that we spend each year on health care, we spend less than 4% on prevention, on keeping people well, doing simple things like good nutrition, exercise, eating breakfast, getting our usual kinds of screens, mammograms. So the reason our health care costs so much is that we don't take very good care of our health.
How well do you think that the lawmakers who are currently arguing over what to do about healthcare in America actually understand the subject?
You know, I feel our lawmakers, what they're arguing about is not healthcare. They're arguing about health insurance. How do you pay? In fact, perhaps the most pervasive health problem we've got in our society is poverty and ignorance. If we could educate our people, get rid of our health illiterate society, and if everybody, if we didn't have so many poor people, well, then we would markedly improve our health. And I'm not sure our lawmakers truly understand many of the problems that they could prevent by providing better services. Things like, I was arguing, let's try to prevent AIDS. Let's try to, or HIV disease. Let's try to prevent teenage pregnancy. Let's try to prevent drug abuse. And if they get it, let's treat them. But we feel that we don't need to do any of that.
Do you think we too narrowly classify what is health in this country and then look at everything else as a social issue or a legal issue?
You've asked a very interesting question. You know, health is far more than absence of disease. It's about community. It's about friends. It's about schools. It's about jobs. It's about where you live. You're now more and more countries, including the United States, are recognizing that the social determinants of health make far more of an impact and improve people's health far more than doctoring. In fact, it's been shown that out of the major determinants of health, access to sick care makes up only 10% of the cause of our death.
Both the House version and the Senate version being discussed right now specifically leave out any guarantee of care for illegal immigrants to this country. Can we fix the problems that we have while not providing care for an estimated right now 11 million people?
You know, I think for us to feel that we can take care of, selectively take care of people and leave others out there, they're still out there free. They can spread disease like tuberculosis. You know, you don't have to have sex with them to get you to get things like tuberculosis. You may HIV disease. You know, there are things that we need to do. We do take care of the woman, let's say, who's pregnant. We give her no prenatal care, and she comes in and delivers in our hospital. Then we may spend $1 million to get that baby taken care of and out of the nursery. It's far better for us to provide education, prenatal care, and take care of her to have a healthy baby than it is to try and wait until she delivers and take care of a low birth weight premature baby.
Let's talk about HIV, because education about this has been sort of everywhere. It's in the schools. I read somewhere the other day that in the District of Columbia, among African Americans, the rate of HIV infection is higher than it is in South Africa.
And that what you read is what I've been reading, that among the African American community, which makes up a large part of Washington, our nation's capital, that the prevalence of HIV disease is higher than in South Africa. And when we look at HIV disease, we find that we have over 1 million people now in the United States with HIV disease of the 33 million or more that's in the world. 1 million are in the United States. Out of that, almost 50% are in African Americans, yet they make up only, African Americans make up only 12 to 13% of the population. 67% of the women with HIV are black. 60+% of the babies born with HIV are black. 60+% of the teenagers with HIV are African American. So you see, it's really very prevalent. It's very out there. And we've got to make sure that we not just target certain populations, that we tailor the message.
Where's the disconnect? To fit them. Where's the disconnect right now with that message?
Well, the disconnect, as far as I'm concerned, is that we've not quite tailored that message to fit the African-American community. You see, we have many people in our African-American community who still walk around and think it's a white gay male disease when they know their friend has it. And we still have many African-American people who feel somehow that it's a God, you know, God caused this to happen.
So you can't control it one way or another.
So you can't control it. So I think that we've got to educate our community and make them understand that this is a disease that we can control. It's preventable. We need to get tested. We need to get informed. We need to get treated if we have the disease. And we need to get involved. And that's something that we've not done yet.
You have always been a supporter of frank discussions of the sexuality of young people. And I wonder if you've come to an understanding of why, for so many American parents, even thinking about the idea that their kids might be having sex, and according to statistics, are having sex, is so incredibly difficult.
You know, we as parents my age, and people that are, you know, younger, having young children now, we were never taught how to talk to our children. And it's very difficult for us to talk to our children, and we're afraid we might say something wrong. And so before we say something wrong, we don't say anything. And this, we have to abide by the HER principle. The HER principle is we've got to be honest. We've got to educate and empower our children so they can be responsible. We've not taught them to be responsible, and we still walk around whispering. Our silence has been deafening, and it's destroying the most valuable resource we've got, our children.
What do you think children take away from growing up in a house where sex is never discussed?
The message that I think children take away from growing up in a house where sex is never discussed is that somehow sex is bad, it's wrong, but they know that that it's really pleasurable, and I consider it child abuse to not educate children about their sexuality. You know, ignorance is not bliss. The more children know, the more responsible they'll be. I mean, we have all of the data out there saying that. You know, the children who've been have had sexuality education have fewer number of partners, usually engage in sex much later. And if they do decide to be sexually active, they make sure that they protect themselves and their partner. But if they don't do that, well, what they do is, you know, they feel that, oh, it just happened. And anything that just happened, well, somehow that turns out to be all right, when it's not all right. I've always been under the impression we want to teach them driver's education. We teach them what to do in the front seat. Let's get busy and teach them what to do in the backseat.
Of course, everyone sort of knows the story that you lost your position in the Clinton administration because you mentioned the fact that perhaps we should include masturbation in school sex curricula. If you could go back, and would you rephrase what you said, or would you say it louder and earlier and in a different way?
Well, you know, I've thought a lot about what I said. You know, I was asked a question about masturbation at a World AIDS Day in December 1994, you know, a few days ago. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized it was the right thing. I said the right thing. You see, masturbation, we couldn't even whisper the word in public. But masturbation never got anybody pregnant, never gave anybody a disease. Won't cause hair to grow in your hands.
Doesn't make you go blind.
Doesn't make you go blind. And I always say, and you know you're having sex with somebody you love. The thing that I was really trying to say is, nobody needs to teach anybody how to masturbate. God taught us how to do that. But the thing we need to do is stop saying it's wrong. You know, to let children, you know, realize it, you should do it in privacy of your own room, and it's not, you know, you aren't going to go to hell. You aren't going to, it's, you know, it's not wrong. So I really think that we have a lot of myths that we carry on our shoulder, and we should let go of some of them.
Do you think it's partially because parents want to think of their children in the same way that children want to think of their parents as sort of sexless individuals?
Yes.
Parents want to think that about their kids.
I think you are absolutely right. None of us, most of us, can never imagine our children having sex, yet we know we're born. So our children can't imagine the parents having sex, just like parents can't imagine their children having sex. And I think that we need to start talking openly and honestly to our children about their sexuality, to really not even want to have it at school. We don't talk about it at church. We don't talk about it in the home. So I don't know where we think our children learn about sex.
Let me stop you there for a moment. We need to take a quick break. My guest is Dr. Joycelyn Elders, former U.S. Surgeon General.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Joycelyn Elders. I want to talk for a minute about drugs. Drug addiction remains a huge health problem in this country, but it is also a law enforcement issue. Is it possible to determine where one side of the problem ends and the other begins?
You know, I have really been, I consider drug addiction a illness, a medical problem. Now, I really think that our laws regard our marijuana laws have caused far more problems than it solved. What we've done is take the young people, or many arrested for marijuana, possession of marijuana, small amounts, they end up in prison, and we've grown our prison system from approximately 200,000 inmates to more than a million inmates. And you know, and it's costing us a fortune. If we would spend near that much money on treatment and on education and teaching our young people about drugs, and when we know somebody has a problem, to really get them into treatment. But it's almost impossible to get them into treatment even once we know. But it's very easy to get them into jail.
What accounts for the difference in our attitudes between the use of smaller or moderate amounts of alcohol to get a little high and smaller moderate amounts of marijuana? Because we really don't. One seems like a moral issue, and another seems like something you do at a party.
Yeah. You know, I really feel that if I had the choice, you know, I feel that small amounts of alcohol, you know, both things in excess are bad. It's bad for the person, it's bad for our society, and it's bad for your health. But I think that marijuana is far less toxic and destructive, even to the body, just say to the human body, than is alcohol. And yet we say alcohol is all right. And then people, when I bring that up, they often tell me, but Dr. Elders, alcohol is legal. I said, but who made it legal? We made it legal. I said, I feel that if we made something like marijuana legal, taxed it, so people would know. I think an often a lot of young people wouldn't even try it because, you know, it would have lost its glamour.
When I was a kid in the 80s, they told us that marijuana was a gateway drug to much harder things. Can you talk about if there's any scientific evidence that shows that marijuana use often leads to using things like heroin and cocaine?
There is no data to suggest that marijuana use leads to heroin and cocaine. You know, it's often that young people that start smoking early, and then they're more likely to go ahead and use marijuana just because they're in the group and in the crowd. But it, as far as the metabolic effect that it has on the body, there is absolutely no data to say that marijuana is a gateway to harder drugs. It's just that they're sold in the same, and you get them in the same kind of environment. And I really feel that if we would legalize marijuana so you could go to the drugstore, buy it, and be charged for it as they do, taxed as they do in many other countries, that the use would markedly decrease.
What do you read into the Obama administration's decision not to have federal agents going after medical marijuana dispensaries? Is that a sign that this administration is open to the possibility down the road of reassessing marijuana?
You know, I don't know what that means. You know, we know that for a very long time, marijuana has been, you know, shown like patients who have cancer or who are nauseated or who, you know, are being treated with certain drugs, that marijuana is a drug that they can inhale. You know, it hits the brain in seconds as opposed to having to go through the stomach, you know. And so that it's much better. But I don't read necessarily anything into the Obama administration about not going after medical marijuana. I don't feel that anybody should go after medical marijuana. I feel that it's a sign that we're coming to our senses. You know, so often our government acts like it's lost its common sense. And I always tell somebody, asks me, I say, well, what, Dr. Elders, what do you mean by that? I said, what I mean by that is common sense is that sense that we all have that make those other five keep those other five senses from acting a fool. So I'm saying that sometimes our laws make no sense. And I think that we should have laws that is in the best interest of all of our people and our country. And so why turn young people into criminals for smoking a pot cigarette when and give them a record? They can't get a job. They can't get loans to go to college. And yet, you know, we think it's all right if they go out and get sloppy drunk on the streets. It makes no sense.
Let's go to Buddy in Fort Worth. Hello, Buddy.
Yes.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Okay. Yes, Dr. Elders. My name is Buddy. I'm in Fort Worth. I'm a doctorate degreed health care provider. I've been in solo private practice for over 30 years. I have been paying into the Social Security system for all of the...
Buddy, are you with us? I'm very sorry. We've just lost your call. Try and call us back, and we will definitely take you back if you can get through on the line. We'll move on to Cindy in Little Elm. Hi, Cindy.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
My question is this. You know, I'm a stay-at-home mom. I have three children. They're grown. My youngest one is getting married on Saturday. Him and his fiance have chosen to keep them to stay virgins until they get married. And I know that in some respects that is a viewed as maybe a religious viewpoint, you might say. But I also believe that if we teach our children that some things it's okay not to do, you know, the pressure for them to be sexually active is out there. I think they need to also hear that you don't have to be sexually active. You don't have to... be part of the crowd. You can abstain and wait until you're married. And I don't think they hear that enough. And I'm just wondering what her view on that is.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. So I think that my view on that is, you know, every mother I know, every teacher I know, every preacher I know, we all teach our children, would like to teach our children to be abstinent and to abstain from sex. Yet we know many of them do not. And I think that we need to support our children regardless of what they do. And I think you should be very proud that your children have decided to abstain until they get married. You know, and I think many there are. We know that what, I don't know, something like 8 to 10% of our young people do abstain from sex until they get married. And I think that that's wonderful, but that's a choice that they made. And I think that we should support that choice. And if they get involved in sex, you know, if your child got pregnant, you know, I think we still need to support our children.
Our email address is think@kera.org. We have an email here from Maureen in Richardson who says, I hear Dr. Elders saying education and poverty reduction are the answers to improving public health. While I agree to some extent, what about educating employers who whine a lot about the cost of providing health benefits but promote a stressful, required overtime work culture that does not allow people to have healthy lifestyles? My husband, for example, does not suffer from ignorance or poverty, but can't leave work in time to exercise or even take an evening walk on weekdays.
Oh, I think you brought up a very interesting question. Employers are more and more, since they pay for what, something like 64% of the health care in America or the health insurance that we have in America, more and more they're learning that if they want healthy employers and they want to make sure that they get the data and that this will drive what they do. And many employers now are beginning to leverage health care that they provide with what's going on at their plant, and they find that it's really working. So I think when your employer finds out that he's stressing his workers out and they're getting more, having a heart attack earlier, getting sick earlier, getting massively overweight, have high blood pressure, other things, that he might want to look at that. And I think that what we need to do is all of us need to look more carefully at what do we need to do to stay healthy. And the things we need to do to stay healthy are fairly simple. As you said, exercise, get plenty of rest, get plenty of sleep at night, eat 3 meals a day, don't engage in excessive drinking or high-risk sexual behaviors. So I think your husband's employer, when his employees are sick and off work, will soon find that out.
You mentioned overweight, and obesity is such a huge problem in this country. And I wonder if you have a theory as to why it is so much worse today than it was when you were a kid, or frankly, when I was a kid.
You know, obesity has increased, has tripled since in the 60s or 70s. One of the great reasons is, of course, we have so much, we're not as active. When I was growing up, I worked from sun up to sundown, so I was nice and thin. And then the other thing is the foods we eat. We have so much, our food is so much better than, quick, that, you know, we couldn't get all the prepared foods that we have. My mother's food was the best there is. I'm not saying that that's not true. You know, our home cook, but now mothers are in the workforce and they don't feel they have time to go home and cook these wonderful meals that I took for granted. And so I think that the food is different. There's more fat and far more salt in our foods. And then we're spending more time watching TV, on the computer, and not getting out and actively exercising. So I think those are the major reasons. And, you know, the other thing that we did, we took physical education out of schools. So our children were not allowed to exercise. We said, well, we've got to teach him about reading, writing, and arithmetic. What good is reading, writing, and arithmetic if you're not physically, emotionally, and psychologically fit?
Dr. Joycelyn Elders is my guest. We'll go next to Jeff in Dallas. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, thanks.
Dr. Elders, I want to tell you that you are one of my heroes for standing up for the things that you've been talking about today.
Thank you.
And I know that you've gotten an awful lot of criticism for them. I do want to mention a specific thing, though, and that is right now, as you pointed out, we're really arguing over health care in the Congress. I'm sorry, over insurance instead of health care. And I don't think we get anywhere until we have universal single-payer system, and it has to do, one of the things has to do with education. For example, in the UK, you walk down to the neighborhood clinic right in your neighborhood, you register with that doctor, and then that doctor receives an annual stipend of a fixed amount for each patient. It's called capitation. And so what happens is, you go to the doctor when you need to, and the doctor has a vested interest in keeping you healthy because if you get sick, he doesn't get any more money for treating you.
That's
and
right.
So, and then you have a personal relationship with a physician in your neighborhood.
I don't disagree with you. I feel that we need to have universal access to health care for all of our people. And until we do that, we'll keep paying these exorbitant prices. You know, it's what? 10% of the people get more than 70% of our health care dollars. And we need to have a patient-centered health care. We need to have a doctor that we call our own, and we need to be responsible for our own health. And we've got to educate our people how to be responsible for their own health, how to eat properly, how to exercise properly, take their medicine. You know, 90% of the people don't take their medication as they should. We call that adherence to the medication. If you just get a strep throat, you're talking about 10 days. Well, many people do not finish that 10-day prescription. What about the people that have, let's say, diabetes or some other chronic disease, and they don't adhere to the medication as ordered? So we're all part of the problem. We've got to better educate our doctors, better educate our nurses, better educate ourselves and educate our children. And nothing is better than having a relationship with your family physician that wants you to stay healthy.
I think no one could argue that in the current climate this is politically feasible. But if it were, would a single-payer guaranteed system be better than this patchwork that we're trying to put together now?
I certainly think that the patchwork that we've been trying to put together for since 1912, for a very long time, this patchwork has not worked. It's only cost us more. The United States, we're the only nation who pays a double digit. We pay 16% of our gross domestic product. The other highest nation is 9.6%. Of their gross domestic product. We are the richest country in the world. We have 25% of the wealth of the world, only 5% of the population, and yet we do not have the best health. And that's because we've not developed a health care system. We keep spending all of our money to pay for very expensive dying rather than paying for people to be healthy.
Would we lose our incentive to innovate in medicine if we were to move to a system like that?
You know how we doctors are? We're always being innovative. We always want to discover something new. We always want to develop a better mousetrap. And so we'll always be out there trying to develop new and better medicine. I think the thing that we could get, I think it's helping doctors a lot with the electronic medical records and more health information technology. You know, we can just find out anything on the computer in a matter of minutes. And I think all of that's important. And I think doctors would continue to provide absolutely the very best medical care there is out there. And they would communicate better with each other. We could know it immediately. So I feel that a single payer or universal access to health care would be just the best thing for this country.
Back in a minute with Dr. Joycelyn Elders.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is former U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Joycelyn Elders. She's in town for the Raggio Endowed Lecture in Women's Studies at SMU tonight at 7. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, and that's where we hear from John, who asks, how close do you think we're getting to finding a vaccine for HIV?
John, I wish I knew how close we were getting to finding a vaccine for HIV. You know, they've developed some vaccines that are 90%. Well, you think, 90%, that's better than nothing. But that means that 10% of the people out there who think they're safe would end up with HIV. So we have to do much better than that. But this is a very elusive virus. Every time they think they're almost there, this virus changes. And so then we've got something different. And they're still working, and I feel that the scientists will find a vaccine. But so far, you know, it's like the common cold. We've been out there looking for years, and we've not found a vaccine for that yet either. But they're still working very hard.
We'll go next to Peter in Arlington. Hey, Peter.
Yes, hello, and good afternoon to you, and welcome, Dr. Elders.
Thank you.
I wanted to say very quickly a comment and question. I had the esteemed pleasure a couple of years ago, you may remember, of being your flight attendant on a flight to Honolulu, Hawaii. And I had absolutely had the best experience in seeing you in person, and have to tell you that we missed all of the efforts that you could have brought to us in this nation by your short tenure. I just wanted to say, I wonder if you feel as though we have an opinion in this country of keeping our head in the sand, or precedence of keeping our head in the sand when it comes to certain issues, such as sexuality and things that people, like you said earlier, don't like to talk about. And if there is such a precedent that exists in this country of doing that, what is it going to take for us to get away from that and, like you said, use common sense? And just to say quickly again, I hope to see you again on a trip to Honolulu.
Thank you. I hope to have such a trip again soon. Peter, I think AIDS made us stop and think for a minute. And I think that we are still working on that issue. I think as we get more and more education, more and more people are informed about healthy sexuality. And that's what we're talking about. We all want to have a sexually healthy life. You know, many people think, well, sex is just for procreation. But 99.99% of sex is for pleasure. I always talk about the three P's, and we talk about pleasure, procreation, and prevention of our partner from disease. And I think parents are beginning to wise up and realize that they want their children informed. They would far rather that they be informed than for them to go out and make ignorant decisions. Ignorance is just not bliss.
Do you think the Surgeon General in this country has an appropriate amount of power?
I feel that the Surgeon General in this country should have the same amount of power as, just say, the people that's over the Defense Department or as the Attorney General, but they don't really. So I feel that that says something about how we think about health. You know, the Surgeon General is really supposed to be informed, inform the Congress, the President, and to really be the leader on health issues in this country. That's just not what's happened. We have more attorneys and more economists and other people deciding about health, and doctors are doing more reacting. I think that we need doctors to get together, come together, and begin to make the health care decisions. I feel that the doctors could bring this country to its knees on health in one day if they decided to do that. And I think that sooner or later, we're going to wake up and, you know, we're so busy taking care of our patients, downstream pulling out bodies, we need to go upstream and fix the bridge.
There's a great amount of mistrust right now of the government's handling of the H1N1 outbreak and of the vaccine distribution. Why do you think there are so many people who are convinced that there is something amiss there's sort of a sense that there's kind of an insidious effort by the government to put vaccine into people who don't want it?
You know, I don't know that. I don't understand what's going on with the H1N1. I think one thing, we don't have an adequate supply. And probably we didn't let out the contracts early enough for them to make enough vaccine so that everybody who wanted it could get it. Well, you know, when that started happening, then, you know, people who didn't get it or felt they should get it or we've run out, well, then, you know, we start making up stories about what we think. None of us really know. But I really think that we are, you know, choosing the people that need it the most, the pregnant women, the babies, young people, are the most important ones to get it. And I think we need to make sure that they all, you know, they get it first. But I think our government may have not let out the contract soon enough. Something may have happened that we didn't really get as big a supply as we needed to, because, you know, they've been talking about how, you know, it takes a while to make it. And they wanted to make sure it was a safe vaccine. You know, we had problems once upon a time with a vaccine, and we certainly didn't want to do that again. And I think that they're trying to make sure it's safe, that we get it to the right people. And I really think they're trying to do the right thing.
Have you had a chance to talk with Dr. Regina Benjamin since her appointment?
No. I know Dr. Benjamin, and I've not talked with Dr. Benjamin specifically. And I think that she'll really be an excellent Surgeon General. And I don't know what is going to be her major issue is, but I feel that they need to hurry and confirm our Surgeon General so she can be involved in the discussions and helping to be involved with health care. You know, we're having all of these big discussions about health care, and we've not felt strongly enough to get our Surgeon General to Washington and get them confirmed so they can be involved. I think that's a problem. But, you know, I'm sure we have plenty of other people, and we have plenty of excellent, excellent physicians at the NIH and CDC and all around. But I think that the Surgeon General should be involved.
Let's go next to Stephen in Denton. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I had a question about early education. How do you feel that general science education for our children could help the health of this country? I know you talked a lot about mysticism and the HIV virus and these kind of things, and here in Texas we've had some pretty big debate over the last year about evolution. So how could just general education and science for children in elementary school really help the health of this country? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Stephen, I feel that we need to start early with children. I feel that we need to have early childhood education. It needs to be age appropriate. It needs to be science based, and we need to make sure that it's true, that it's honest. And so I think that you can't teach children too early. I think children, you know, learn and know much more than we think they know. We leave too much of what they learn to TV, to girly magazines, to the streets, to their friends. So, and you know, we as parents may think we can teach our children everything, but I can assure you that they learn far more from other people often than they learn from us. What they need to learn from us are the facts. They need to be science-based. If we don't know ourselves, we need to go out and find out. So we can teach them, and regardless of what somebody else says, if you've taught them the right thing, they'll believe you. But if you've told them some things that they find out aren't true, then they begin to lose confidence in you.
Since we're talking about education right now, and since you're giving a women's studies lecture tonight, I'm really interested in this, the fact that women lag behind men in terms of their numbers in many of the sciences, but not in medicine. In fact, medical schools, I think, now have more women enrolled than men. What do you think accounts for that?
Well, you know, medicine is kind of a woman's profession, if you will. You know, the nature of women. You know, we tend to be a lot more nurturing. We are, you know, we are very much into the kind of caring for people. We provide more than 75% of the health care already. You know, and, you know, health care is not just when you're in the doctor's office. It's what goes on at home, what goes on in the neighborhood, what goes on in schools. But women, I think, very much, you know, but it used to be almost all the nurses were women. That's changing over now. We're getting more and more men. But I think that women, this is a profession that they really can shine in, that they do well in. And this is something that is kind of inbred into their DNA, if you will, to be nurturers and caring for people. And that's what doctors do.
Let's go next to, Rafael in Arlington. Hi, Rafael.
Hi, I'm Rafael Soto. I'm 16, a student at TCC, and I have both a comment and a question.
Okay.
I felt that being 16, my point of view would be valid in this segment. When I got into high school at 15, me and a couple of friends were looking at the classes, and we scoffed at the idea that there was a health class teaching abstinence and what are the risks, and not a sex ed class teaching anything about prevention or, you know, how to be safe about it. And we found that obsolete and stupid. And my question is, do you think it would be possible to see sex ed classes by the time my kids are in high school?
Thanks.
It could be around 20 to 30 years.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I hope so. I've been trying to get comprehensive health education in schools from kindergarten through 12th grade forever. And I think you're absolutely right. We've spent billions of dollars to show that abstinence only does not work, that we've got to really educate young people. And if we educate them appropriately, many of them will choose abstinence. So I agree with you, and I think that your parents have probably obviously educated you, and hopefully your church has worked on educating you, and I hope that you aren't having to pick up all your information from the streets.
What would change if we classified healthcare as a human right?
I feel that healthcare is a human right. It's not a privilege, and it should be a right in this country, but we've not allowed it to be so. We've allowed it to be a privilege for many people. I tell people all the time that our health care system is in a mess, or our sick care system. And a mess means misery and evil side by side. We need to make sure that we provide health care for all people. And make it a right. And I don't think it would cost any more than what we're doing. Nothing could be more destructive and expensive than what we're doing right now. And I think we would have healthier people. Companies would have healthier employees. We would have fewer people warehoused in prison. We would have many of the people that have mental illnesses. In fact, 90%+ of all the mental illnesses are treatable now. And yet we have 13 or 14 million people out there who aren't being treated and cared for because of the stigma associated with it. So I feel that if we made it a right for everybody, that we would markedly reduce the illnesses that we have and markedly improve the health of the people.
We have less than a minute left, but I want to ask you if the way that you teach students now in the medical school is different from the way it was a few decades ago.
The way students are being taught now, I think, is better. Our students are more involved. They're more nurturing. We try and teach cultural competency. We didn't worry about that in the past. We talk about the socioeconomic problems related to poverty. And so I think our students are much better informed. They're much better doctors. They're much more compassionate. And they're much more involved. And they're still good scientists.
Dr. Joycelyn Elders is a pediatrician and former Surgeon General of the United States. Dr. Elders, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.